Well, hi there, Jonathan Doyle once again. Welcome to the Being Catholic Weekly Podcast. As usual, we've got another fantastic guest. This week we're going to be talking to Professor Celia Hammond, who is the Vice Chancellor at Notre Dame University. And it's a really interesting interview with a Catholic woman really at the forefront of higher education in the Catholic world. And there's just so much rich stuff in here. You are going to notice a little technical glitch. Towards the end of the interview, we had a dropout on our Skype recording over the internet, and we fixed that as fast as possible. But you may notice a slight glitch there where we talked about the new evangelization, but you're still going to get so much great stuff out of this interview. So sit back, relax. I hope you got a chance to listen to this on an iPod or on your phone, and hope you really enjoy this interview with Professor Celia Hammond. Professor Celia Hammond, thank you so much for joining us on the Being Catholic podcast. The day gets underway a little bit earlier for you guys. It's only still relatively early in the day over there.
9 o'clock, which is not too early, but yeah, we're still the 3-hour time difference.
Fantastic.
It's annoying. Yes.
How's your weather there today?
It's absolutely beautiful. It's a beautiful autumn day. It's going to be about 32 degrees. So it's warm, but it's got that autumn sun, you know, which it doesn't strike quite as hot as in summer, and it's not as glary, so it's beautiful.
Well, fantastic. I don't think there's a lot of places in the world that get 32 degrees in autumn. But
so, you're in Sydney, aren't you, or are you Melbourne?
A little bit further south. We're based in Canberra, and for listeners overseas, that's the national capital. But as I always say to people, I'm responsible for nothing of what goes on here. But this is home. But I was actually born in Perth. I was actually born not too far from where you are. I was born at St John of God Hospital there in Subiaco.
Ah, fantastic. How long did you live in Perth for?
I only had the pleasure of being there for 3 months.
Is that right?
And
You never get it out of you, though.
No, I've made a few visits. My first visit back, I only got as far as the transit lounge returning from Africa. But I get over there once a year or so for some conference stuff, so it's always great to visit.
Yeah, it is a lovely place.
So thank you for making some time with us this week. I'm fascinated by your biography. You're now working in Catholic higher education, but you've had an extensive career in the legal area. So tell us a little bit about your journey, firstly, in the legal area.
It's fascinating. I think I've come full circle in many ways. It starts with my mum being a teacher and my father, who was a lawyer, then a judge. The whole way through school, all I wanted to be was a teacher. And in fact, I wanted to be a primary school teacher. And in about, when I was in about year 10, when you had to go off and do work, work experience, yep. I went to a primary school, and I remember spending 2 weeks just laughing at what the kids did. They just entertained me, and it was at that point that I thought, I might have a problem with discipline or with actually achieving anything, because really I did spend 2 weeks just in gales of laughter.
Yeah.
Following that, as I went into year 11 and year 12, the subjects and the sort of things that fascinated me, I got into debating. It was literature, it was history, it was economics, and I guess the influence of having a parent in the law led me to law school. When I left school, I absolutely loved law school. I absolutely loved and still do the study of law. I think it's fascinating. It challenges you, it stretches you, your brain in various ways. But when I finished studying at university and I went out into legal practice, into private practice, I stayed in private practice for a bit over 2 years, and I didn't enjoy it at all. There was a very big difference between the love of the law that I had developed and my experience in private practice. After 2 years, there was points where on a Friday I'd get depressed because the next working day was a Monday, that after 2 years, 2 years and 1 month actually, I decided that if I didn't get out now, I could become trapped. get used to the income, get used to the manner of life, and I wasn't actually happy. I wasn't feeling fulfilled. I wasn't feeling like I was achieving anything. Now, I have to say, I worked with some wonderful people, so that actually made the decision easier because I knew it wasn't the people I was working with. Yeah. I had some wonderful bosses there and some wonderful colleagues. So when you know that it's not the people that you're working with, but it's actually the work that you're doing, you know, it does make the decision a bit easier.
So what was that fundamental difference? Because you talk quite passionately about the study of law in law school, and when you came into private practice, was it the sort of utilitarian is the wrong word, but was it the sort of having to generate, you know, billing hours, all that sort of stuff?
Yes.
That's what it was?
It was essentially that. It was that. I guess a lot of people who go into law, and I think I fall into this category, you've got a strike of perfectionism in you. Not saying that you actually achieve perfection ever, but this streak of always wanting to do the absolute best and not wanting to sort of do anything less than that. So going out into private practice where the emphasis is on billing, it's on servicing clients, but ultimately, you know, you have to bill a certain amount per month.
You do.
You have to account for your days in 6-minute lots.
Yep.
I think that's still current practice in the legal field now. It just didn't sit with me because there'd be times when I'd be researching something or looking up something and wanting to spending a lot of time on it. And then you record it on the timesheet and you'd sit there thinking, well, is this justified that this should actually be, you know, the fact that I have wanted to spend this time on it? Yeah. And you do have to account for your time. But is it justifiable that this gets charged back to a client?
Yeah.
So there were all those sorts of pressures. There was also, I came out, I started work in a law firm in the early 1990s, and there was a recession at that time. And so it was pretty cutthroat, as much as we were all, you know, it was a very good group of people I was working with. It was very, very competitive. So if you're already a person who has got a slight tendency to perfectionism, or, you know, slight tendency towards a type A personality or whatever, you know, whatever it's characterised as, that extra level of competition is not good either. So, you know, worrying about your billing hours as opposed to worrying about the quality of the work, about other things. I just found it very, very unfulfilling.
So let me take you back a little bit. You mentioned early on about the home you grew up in. It must have been interesting to have a mother who was a teacher, and teachers often become great generalists across a whole range of knowledge, and a father who was a lawyer and then went on to be a judge. There must have been some interesting conversations, and I guess learning, reading was pretty central growing up.
Oh, reading was a huge part of growing up.
Yep.
They were both, and they both still are, they're avid readers.
Yep.
You know, because I had three sisters, so there were four girls. One of my fondest memories is actually, because we grew up until I was about 10 in the country town, and then we moved to Perth.
Yep.
And one of my fondest memories, so I would have been about 10, so well and truly able to read by myself. But my mum, I shared a room with my younger sister. My mum, over the course of 2 weeks, I think it was, coming in every night and reading us a chapter of The Hobbit.
Wow.
So we were well and truly able to read ourselves, but I still have a distinct recollection of that. Mum was a literature teacher and an English teacher. So, yes, the house was full of books. Full of reading.
So just on a tangent, there was a great cartoon in, I think it was in The Australian maybe 12 months ago, and it was talking about, you know, the Kindles and the iBooks and all that stuff, and there was like it was kind of like a book fair, and there was a huge line to access the latest title coming out on Kindle, and there was this one solitary little table with a person standing there, and it said, the sign for this table, I won't do it justice, but it basically said, you know, for people that like to smell sell books, and there's this one person standing there. And we don't need to cover this exhaustively, but what do you think about that? I mean, the massive transition to online digital learning. Do you think we're losing anything from just that whole tactile sensory experience of books as we've known them?
Absolutely. I'm pretty much an old-fashioned person in that regard.
Yep.
I do think we are, but I also personally, I can't read off a tablet.
Yep.
And in fact, off a screen, if something's more than a couple of pages long, I actually have to print it. It's the way I read. I could probably teach myself other ways, but that's the way I do it. The whole notion of holding the book in your hands and it's that love of the book. I do think that there is something, it's something about the physicalness, you know, that connection between the physical touching of a book and it going in. I've actually got three children now, and my eldest is 11, and he out of all of them, I think, has developed that same great passion for reading. His room is, he doesn't have enough bookshelves. His walls are held up by books. And he now has occasionally read books off his tablet, but he still, and so he's 11 and he's, you know, they have compulsory iPads at school, which I'm not necessarily in favour of, but there you are. Yeah. So he's very much, can use all the digital equipment, uses it far more than I do, but he still has that passion for real books. Nothing, you know, they love going into bookshops.
Yep.
They love buying books.
That's if you can find one. I think we're down to about two here in Canberra, which is, you know, and we've got a big population.
Really?
Yeah, we're down to about two major ones. But so tell us a little bit about what you're doing now. So you've gone from being a general counsel and a whole bunch of stuff that you're doing, you have done in the legal profession. What are you doing at Notre Dame at the moment? What's your average day look like?
It's an interesting one. I'm now the vice chancellor, which is the equivalent of, I guess, a principal in a school or a chief executive officer in a business organisation. According to my children, if I was to answer this, what they'd say that I do at work would be have meetings, answer emails, and talk with people, which isn't entirely inaccurate.
Yep.
Although I don't think they have any concept of what is done in meetings.
Yep.
A lot of my day is spent with people.
Yep.
It's in guiding, listening, advising on various aspects. It's setting the strategy of the university. It's trying to, you know, overseeing what's happening, making sure that there are systems, processes in place to ensure that the university can achieve what it wants to achieve and what it's been set up to achieve. There's never a dull day. I've actually worked at Notre Dame for 15 years, and I can genuinely say in that time I have never had a day that's been boring.
Now, tell me a little bit. I'd have to say in the last few years I've heard really fantastic stuff about Notre Dame. Now, in our business, we, you know, have exposure to a huge, the scope of Catholic education from bishops to schools. And I've been so impressed. I mean, my exposure has been primarily to what's happening in Sydney. But what is the secret sauce at Notre Dame? Why, I mean, my humble and sort of uneducated opinion is that the closer that you have tied, not you personally, but that the leadership of which you would be a member has tied the university to the broader aims of Catholic education and the evangelising mission of the church, it seems to be giving people a pretty compelling choice. It's almost as if you've taken a position. So what are your thoughts on that? What's the secret sauce? What's working well there? Why do you think it's the university seems to be flourishing?
That's a very, very big question.
It is broad.
It's very broad. I guess what I could start with is where I would start with is Catholic education and the whole beauty and joy and role and goal of Catholic education, which is you know, the purpose is to educate the whole person. It is to welcome people and to give them an education. It sounds trite, but an education for life. Yeah. And so to avoid it sounding trite, it's not just about training in a discipline. It's not just about giving them knowledge. It's not just about rote learning. It's also about giving them opportunities to develop themselves spiritually, to understand faith, to develop socially, to develop physically. So it's that notion of the whole person, and that being the goal of Catholic education, which is just as relevant at you know, primary, secondary, and at tertiary education, which I think is what it's certainly what guides this university. It's certainly what drives this university. It's what we're based on, and I think that it's such a wonderful basis. It's such a wonderful thing that it can't help but flourish in many ways. You know, it's a rare privilege. Anybody who's working in Catholic education, it's a rare privilege to work in it. And, you know, it's almost the sort of thing that you have to deliberately try and stuff up to make it not work.
That's right.
Yeah,
So tell me about your own journey, you know, as a person of faith. You could have done any number of different, you could have worked obviously in many places, but you chose to spend the last 15 years in a Catholic institution. What's sort of your own journey of faith? Was it strong as you grew up? Was it something you encountered later? What's your own sort of journey been like?
I grew up in a Catholic family, and in the 60s and 70s, I do often say the Catholic schooling then, post-Vatican II, the Catholic schooling system certainly in the West was very much focused on social justice and on doing good. Yeah. I can't say that we ever had much at school, or I don't recall it, and I don't want to criticise anybody involved in Catholic education at the time. Yeah. But we didn't have much in catechesis, the education about the Catholic faith. Yeah. It was the concept of the doing good, which is great. But I do see that there was a lack, and that's now one of my passions about, you know, drawing the connection between faith, Jesus, and doing good. Yeah. But I grew up in a Catholic family, and, you know, 70s and 80s, went to church every weekend, observed all, you know, the holy days, did Friday Lent, you know, all of that, yep. All of the traditional Catholic practices. Did it at school too, because I went through a Catholic school. When I went to university, I'd have to say that, and this is another reason why I'm passionate about Catholic higher education, I think my own experience when I went to university in the middle 1980s, went from a Catholic school to a very secular university, a public university, and there was a great period there where I'd say that faith wasn't all that important to me. Yeah. It was obviously, well, it wasn't consciously important to me. Yeah. It was obviously ingrained within me. I think part of the experience, if I look back on it now, of not liking legal practice, is it also is at a point, I guess, in my life where my faith, I wasn't consciously engaging with my faith at all.
Yeah.
I guess travelling back a bit, once I left legal practice, I went and started teaching and doing my master's at UWA. And, you know, that's what I say, it's my parents' fault. My mum the teacher, my dad the lawyer. I ended up combining the two, and fell in love with it. Again, I love law, I love teaching.
Yeah.
And after I'd been at UWA teaching for 3.5 years, the Notre Dame Law School was opening up and they advertised for staff, and I applied for it, applied for a position. Now at the time, again, it was probably at that period I was starting to engage a little bit more with my faith, but it certainly wasn't that strong.
Mm.
And the idea of working in a Catholic institution, in a fledgling law school, and being able to be involved and being involved and engaged with people much more closely than in other organisations that I'd seen, really attracted me to Notre Dame. And Greg Craven, who was the foundation dean of the law school, was very persuasive and made a very compelling case for coming. So then I came 15 years ago as a lecturer in the law school. And over that 15 years, I guess you could say it was the Holy Spirit guiding me. My faith has increased and multiplied, and whether it's increased or multiplied, it's become, again, a very, very conscious part of me.
So why have you seen a growth in that? What is it about where you are and what you do that when you say you've seen your faith increase and develop, why is that?
In many ways, it's being part of an organisation where the faith is present, where the faith is visibly present, where there's symbols, there's services, there's an encouragement. It's visibly present. It's not an afterthought. Yeah. There's prayers. It's there. So it makes you, for a start, at a very, I guess, superficial level, it makes you aware that it's here. It also makes that level of if not comfort, but that level of naturalness. Okay, this is here. This is where we are. The other thing is, and this is the true, one of the true privileges of working in a Catholic institution with schools of philosophy and theology, is that I got to meet and talk and discuss with theologians, with philosophers, with ethicists. And as I said before, when I went through schooling in the 70s and 80s, there wasn't much catechesis. There wasn't much, there was no theology, if you like, that we didn't learn. I don't have this sense of learning about the faith when I was at Catholic school. But being in an environment where you're with theologians, where you're with ethicists, where you're with philosophers, and you actually get to discuss with them things about the faith, and to learn and to understand, tradition, revelation, to actually
ask questions, I guess.
Ask questions and to just be able to engage in that has just been magnificent.
So if we were looking at this from a sort of an organisational psychology perspective, is it fair to say that what's happening structurally is that there's a kind of permission being given and reinforced through what you've identified, which is, definite concrete circumstances such as prayer and liturgy, but is it true that organisationally it gives people permission to both be Catholic and to explore their faith more deeply?
Yes, I actually think yes. I think the university has always been like that, but I do think, and that's been my personal experience, and that has helped my own faith journey and my own, development, spiritual and religious development. I do think that there is definitely an element of that. It's that permission. The permission.
So the other thing I wanted to ask you a little bit about is, how your faith informs your daily practice. And to lead into that, I guess my observation over probably half a decade, if not longer now, is part of the postmodern project and aspects of a militant secular project is the idea of removing faith from the public square, and that it's fine for you to have a nice personal religious faith, but it mustn't impact the public square. Now, I've often countered that by saying, well, if you're an atheist, which is fine, how can that not inform your professional practice? So I don't think we challenge that enough with sort of a rigorous argument, but let's talk about you. How does your faith inform, energise what you do and why you do it?
Yeah, I agree with you. And in fact, on your observations about, of course, it must influence you, I also think in many ways it's more honest if you actually acknowledge the impact that your faith has on you in public life. It's far more honest to acknowledge it, and you know, in all its positiveness, rather than to try and say no, it doesn't inform me or it doesn't impact on me. My answer to that question is that I find it very difficult, and I'd even look back on those years when my faith was, you know, was not a conscious part of my living. Even then, I think that the faith is so ingrained in me that I find it very difficult to actually separate exactly how it influences me, yeah, as opposed to, say, my background, my education, my gender, my family, you know, my kids, anything. I do find it difficult. And this is why I think, you know, in public life, saying that you can somehow separate them, I think it's a fallacy. If you've got true faith or no faith, it's a fallacy. What I would say though is that I am most conscious of it. I am most conscious of and deliberately try and remove myself to a particular space when I'm having to make decisions, hard decisions which impact on people.
Sure.
That's when I am very, very conscious of actually stepping back. I'm firmly of the mindset that just because something is legal, just because it makes financial sense, does not make it right.
Yeah. It's interesting. I often share a quote from Abraham Lincoln who said, I've been driven to my knees more times than I can remember by the overwhelming awareness that I had nowhere left to go. It's a great line.
That is a great line.
But listening to you, it's, I guess, what I've been trying to share in the many years that we've been working with educators is the Catholic view of the human person in the image of God filters into just about every aspect of law, politics, ethics.
Yes.
And is that part of it? Is it that in your practice of your vocation, but in your decision making, somewhere behind it all, and you just mentioned a second ago, is how does this impact people? And that presupposes the first question, which is, what is a person? What's their destiny? Which is, as you started this interview with, it's Christological. It's, you know, that the person is multifaceted, multidimensional.
That's right.
Yeah. So,
and everybody's created in the image of God, and everybody has got gifts and talents. And that is the other thing about Catholic. Everybody has got gifts and talents, and we all have both the right and, I would say, the obligation to develop and nurture our own gifts and talents to the utmost. And that's part of what Catholic education does. But then it's also, Catholic education is about saying, okay, you've got this right, you've got this obligation to develop your gifts and talents. You are a unique individual. You also must do good with them.
I guess that's kind of where Catholic institutions such as Notre Dame can be countercultural, in the sense that the broader sort of materialist project is develop every ability you have, but the end point and the reference point of your abilities is essentially yourself and what you can attain or achieve. And I guess, is it fair to say that in a Catholic perspective, that's partially true, but the bigger emphasis is what, you know, what can you do with what you have to serve others, to serve the broader community?
Absolutely. You know, and to raise that awareness that it is not just about yourself. It's not just about doing things for your own individual advancement. That there is this we are a community. We do have an obligation to act in the common good. One of the things that I think is probably that has driven me a lot in what I've written and said in recent years, because I give quite a number of talks to young people, is the rising notion of moral, you know, of moral relativism, that there's no absolute right or wrong. And you know, our culture is such that it just pervades everywhere. Pick up, you know, look at a movie, look at any shows. It's a constant, nothing is right or wrong, moral relativism. And in many ways, the way that I see it, it's our duty and it's our obligation and it's our privilege to actually challenge that and to get people to actually challenge that and to realise that they're not necessarily being nasty or discriminatory if they actually find that some behaviour is not good.
Yeah.
You know, people are permitted to make judgments that certain behaviour, certain actions are not good. And yet we seem to be in a world where if you make a statement like that about something, you know, abortion or abortion being, I guess, a key one. If you make a statement like that, you know, abortion is wrong, that somehow you are hurting, you are being nasty, you're acting in a way against all of those who support it.
You've picked up on a critical point, and I've sort of encapsulated over the years as a kind of anti-intellectualism. Like if you disagree with a perspective, that you call the person a bigot or on the wrong side of history, tends to be the current favourite, that you sweep away any capacity for, you know, I guess what we call respectful dialogue. It's kind of a blunt instrument. And I guess, the ability to make value judgments and to present cases and arguments for those seems to be under some threat in the public square.
Absolutely. Absolutely. The minute you call somebody racist, you call them discriminatory. Dare I say it, you call them a misogynist. Yeah. You call them a bigot. Once you throw out something like that, dialogue ceases. The person on the other end, how do you disprove any of this?
Yeah.
You know, it'll come across as, I don't know, I find it very, very dispiriting when it happens.
Yeah, and I think it's, you know, if you look at everybody from, say, people like Timothy Dolan in New York, and some of the best male and female Catholic thinkers in the world are drawing attention to that need to re-engage the public square, to actually, you know, to be involved in public debate. I guess that's where our Catholic higher education institutions are going to become increasingly important.
Yes.
I had two other things I wanted to cover with you, and one was, I'm not sure if it's a loaded question. It's definitely been in the papers a lot, with some of the most well-known female executives in the world have been weighing into this one recently. So I want to talk a little bit about women in the life of the church and your experience.
Yes.
And I've been very blessed to marry a woman some years ago now who's been able to make an enormous contribution as a woman in the life of the church, and we both, Karen and I, have had a deep formation in John Paul II's, I guess, concept of the genius of womanhood, the feminine genius.
Yes.
I've been lucky to meet incredible women like, you know, Professor Tracy Rowland and Marie Therese, who we interviewed recently, and
yeah.
I see many great women doing amazing things in the life of the church. You're doing amazing stuff while, you know, you've got a young family still. Thoughts and reflections on women in the life of the church? Is it beaten up out of proportion? Are there things you'd like to see change? What are your thoughts on the whole thing?
Fascinating you should ask that.
Yeah.
And I know this is going to sound so staged,
yeah,
but I actually, reading on the weekend, I've just got a copy of it here, John Paul II's On the Dignity and Vocation of Women.
Yeah.
It's interesting, that's the other, you know, it comes back to being at a Catholic university, that I did actually spend time reading that on the weekend, because I do have to do a presentation on this precise topic in a couple of months, and I find myself not necessarily educated or knowledgeable about it, and so I've been doing some background reading and trying to I guess, better educate myself on it. I think is it beaten up? I think that some of the issues in some with some people have become confused. We've sort of, you know, the whole women's liberation movement, getting equality for women in the workplace, equal pay, etc. that to some has been transferred across without necessary as much thought and reflection to the church. Yeah. For some who are constantly or who seem to just be fixated on the need that we need to have women priests, for example, yeah. To me that's just a simple transfer of the women's liberation movement into the church, and to me that it, you know, it's missing the point, or it's missing several points. Yeah. The role of the women in role of women in the church, you know, I think it's not a one issue. It's not an issue about women being able to become priests. Mm. To me, that is, it's you know, it falls into the same trap that, you know, name calling people, calling them misogynist. It's reduction, putting it down to one. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah. Women have always had a very powerful role in the church. Let's not make, let's not undermine the role that the religious orders have, you know, women religious have over the centuries contributed enormous amounts, particularly in Catholic education and Catholic healthcare. In Australia, you know, the orders of nuns who have established the Catholic health system, who educated, so we are all direct beneficiaries of them, and they have had an enormous role at the coalface and on the ground of the church. And so I think one thing we can say is that in many ways, you know, like the real world, you know, not the real world, like the secular world, women are moving into to different roles within that. Mm. And so they are assuming in the church too, you know, for example, leadership roles in Catholic organisations. But women have always had a very strong and powerful role in the church.
Well, you look back at people like Catherine of Siena and Teresa Miller, I mean, doctors of the church, of which there's but a handful. So what I'll do is at the end of the interview is I'll put in the notes under this, I'll Karen, my wife's written extensively on it and wrote a book called The Genius of Womanhood. So I'm going to put some free access to that for everybody.
Oh, fantastic,
and,
yeah.
And she's got a great downloadable talk, and I'll put that under there as well. But all right, so let's begin to wrap up. We want to talk a little bit about the new evangelization. The church is about to go through an interesting time here in this country. We're going to see some big stuff with the Royal Commission. My particular interest of late is around the issue of gay marriage. I don't want to get into that topic on an ethical basis, but more what that will mean for Catholic education in terms of once there becomes direct conflict between any religion's core teachings and the law. I'm just wondering how that's going to play out over time. But the church under Pope Francis is really being encouraged to go back out. And from John Paul back in the New Evangelization, what do you think the church can or should be doing at the moment to really re-engage with culture? What can we do to get out of the bunker mentality? What can we do?
Well, my personal views on this is that, and in some respects, it's my views are shaped by my own experiences, is that unlike, and I talk about Australia particularly, and the developed world, unlike, you know, 100 years ago, we are now a very materially affluent, on the large part, society.
Well, hi again. As I mentioned, this is the spot where we had a small technical glitch with Skype. The question that I'd framed for Professor Hammond was a question around the new evangelization and what schools and universities can do to really go forward back into the public space. So we do miss a few of her points, but the interview is about to pick up again where she talks about some of the practical strategies that they're doing at Notre Dame to really once again re-evangelize culture.
Talk. On some aspect of theology. There's one this week on transubstantiation. We are deliberately choosing things that people will have heard about but may not have any understanding. So, and so we call it theology 101, if you like.
So there's the practical steps, but the other thing that occurs to me is something a little bit more intangible, which is the new evangelization is going to require courage. It's going to, and especially whether it's a particularly Australian thing, is that you don't want to actually go out there and say to anybody, hey, I've got this extraordinary good news for you. You know, where do we find the courage to begin these initiatives or to begin entering into that public space? Where does the courage come from?
It's a question of, I think people have the courage definitely to do things and to spread it, but we have to, Australian society, you know, we're not like the Americans. You know, you see TV evangelists in America and it's a completely different world. Yeah. You know, that sort of thing just doesn't go down well in Australia. But I think Australians, if people had the courage to go out and do, so lead by example and then explain the connection and then explain what motivates, my personal view is that that would go down much better in Australian society than just, for example, walking somewhere and saying, hey, I've got some good news for you.
Yeah.
So it's leading by example, showing, and then explaining.
So to finish, tell me a little bit about your hopes for Notre Dame in general. So when a young person comes to their campus and leaves after 3 or 4 years, what have they encountered in a genuinely Catholic institution that is different to what they may have encountered elsewhere? What are your hopes for this institution that you're really serving with your life?
Above all else, I hope that what they've encountered is love.
Yep.
And I, you know, say that when I welcome students to the university at orientation days, I have what I call the 4 L's. Yep. To learn, to live, to laugh, to love. And then I added a 5th L after a gospel to also be light. So there's actually now 5 L's.
Yep.
I really want them to have experienced love. Love from others, and to have experienced the love of God. Mm. So that, above all else, is what I hope every single one leaves. And to varying degrees that love then guides them in all that they do post Notre Dame. Of course, I hope that they're professionally excellent. Of course, I hope that they've increased their knowledge. I that goes without saying. That's a university. But if I was to say the one thing, assuming that is all done, that they have experienced love, that they understand more about the faith and the love of God, and that they have the courage to go out and let love be their guide.
So how do you bring colleagues with you? Like, there'll be many teachers in secondary schools listening to this, there'll be principals, RECs, who have the passion that you have, but in your experience over 15 years, you know, to talk about love, to talk about wanting those students to have encountered Christ in their relationships with peers, with staff, how do you bring people with you in your own day-to-day experience as a leader in Catholic education? You've articulated your vision and your desire for the future of that institution. How do you get people to come with you?
It's a very good question.
You pay them large amounts of money and kidnap their children.
No, in fact, that's the funny thing. You know, as a Catholic institution, we don't pay exorbitant amounts. We pay very just wages, but we're certainly not the highest payer out there.
Yeah.
We also expect people to work damn hard, all. So it's definitely not pay. I think, personally, to bring people, for anybody to bring others along with them, there has to be a level of sincerity.
Yeah.
If you are not passionate, if you are not sincere, if you are not in love with what you are doing and love what you are doing and being guided by something bigger than yourself, then I think it's very difficult to bring people with you. So you have to have commitment. You have to be completely sincere and 100%. People smell frauds.
Yeah.
So you need that. But also, I mean, we have many Catholic and we have many non-Catholic staff on working at the university. But all of them, if there is a sincerity behind what we are trying to achieve and behind the leadership group in what we are trying to achieve, all of them can easily accept that and follow that. That's one of the beautiful things about Notre Dame. There are daily gripes, you know, as there are with any organisation. There are things that annoy and irritate people till they want to pull their hair out. And yet we all keep at it. We all persist with it because we are doing it for a higher purpose.
Yeah.
And I don't say that necessarily I'm bringing people along with me at all. I don't see it that way. I'm the current custodian of this position at Notre Dame. That's how I see my role. It's the higher mission and the higher purpose of what we are doing that brings people along. I guess what I have to do is try and articulate that so that people respond to it. But, you know, in my garbled way, I hope that answers it.
And how do you, in the midst of all that you do, both from the strategic level, the practical level, how do you restore yourself? Is it reading? Is it personal prayer? Is it sacraments? What is it that, could you point to, one or two small things that you do that keep you from burning out, that keep you from becoming cynical? That what do you do for self-care in the adventure of Catholic education?
Okay, self-care, that's an interesting one. I try and have a laugh every day. I do believe in the power of laughter, and so having at least one laugh, and sometimes it's very black humour or it's, but I think you need to do that.
Yep.
It is prayer. It is moments of stopping, I guess. My cynicism stops when I'm and I think that this is the Holy Spirit at work. When I'm and I was doing something, giving an awards ceremony last week, and I actually ended up telling everybody there this exact story. It had been one of those days where everything was an irritation, where nothing seemed to be working out. So I was really grumpy. Mm. 3 hours later, I was at an awards ceremony, giving out awards to students for service activities, for academic achievement, for all sorts of things, and sitting there, I almost have tears in my eyes because I think this is what stops the cynicism. I'm looking out at the face of Christ, so many faces of Christ. So those restore me, and of course my family, yeah. My three boys, my husband, and my wider family. They have just been the biggest blessing in my life, honestly.
Fantastic.
Little boys and their the way they view the world, and it's wonderful.
Pretty cool. My little boy turned 4 this morning.
Oh, how gorgeous!
So he's very easy to please. So we actually had, as I've shared before, we had 3 kids under 3.5 years of age. So pardon?
I had 3 under 3.5.
Oh, there you go, and you're still here. You survived.
I know. Yes, exactly. You do start to get more sleep.
And look, my final question for you today is: I know you're going to dodge this one because you're going to say that you don't want to presuppose that you would have a perfect answer. But one piece of advice for Catholic educators, leaders out there: what's one thing, if you were going to say to them, was crucial, was central to their service, to their survival, to their growth in Catholic education? What would it be?
To keep the faith.
Yeah.
And when the times, in anything, when everything seems too much, to go back to basics, to go back to the faith. Absolutely. That's what restores everything.
Yeah. I guess it's like when Peter says, you know, when Jesus said to the disciples, do you want to leave me as well? And Peter says, well, you know, you have the words of eternal life. To whom else would we go?
Yeah.
So, well, despite the best and worst attempts of technology, listeners will notice a couple of glitches here. But Professor Celia Hammond, Vice Chancellor at Notre Dame, we want to thank you very much for your time, and we're going to post a bunch of stuff under this, some links to some stuff on the Genius of Womanhood. But thank you for your time, and thank you so much for your service of young people and of Catholic education.
Thank you very much, Jonathan, and thank you.
Fantastic. Thank you. Well, there you go, some fantastic insights from Professor Celia Hammond, Vice-Chancellor at the University of Notre Dame. I really hope you got some great information out of this podcast. If you head back to the website, you can find some links to the talks that I mentioned from Karen on the Genius of Womanhood, and also all the social sharing links there. It'd be great if you could share the post, share the interview with different friends. You can use the email functions or share the website on Twitter, Facebook, Google+. Or wherever else you may feel somebody would enjoy having listened to this great content. Thank you once again for the privilege and the privilege of your time on the Being Catholic podcast. If you think there's somebody you'd love me to interview, make sure you flip me an email and let me know. And I'm also excited to let you know that in just a short time, we're going to be introducing a whole new platform for Catholic education, where we're going to be releasing some great daily video content to membership subscribers. So I want to put that on your radar and let you know that our commitment to giving you great regular content on the adventure of Catholic education and the whole experience of being Catholic is really going to be something we're committed to in the years ahead. I'm Jonathan Doyle. This has been the Being Catholic Weekly Podcast, and I'm sure you will hopefully be listening to my voice in just a week's time. Speak soon.